We're starting again today, as we did yesterday, with an important court decision. Yesterday, we focused on the Supreme Court's decision to let stand Michigan's ban on the use of race in public university admissions that was passed by the voters a while back. Today, we want to talk about an issue the justices actually decided to bypass. Florida Governor Rick Scott hoped the court would hear an appeal stemming from an executive order to drug test all state workers, about 85,000 people. A lower court said the order was unconstitutional, calling it a violation of the Fourth Amendment, which protects citizens from unreasonable search and seizure. We wanted to know what the Supreme Court's decision not to hear the case means for this drug testing issue in Florida and elsewhere around the country. So we called Kurt Anderson, a Florida legal affairs reporter for the Associated Press, and Pauline Kim, professor of law at Washington University School of Law, and she specializes in employment and privacy law. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Kurt Anderson, I'm going to start with you. What did the Supreme Court say about Governor Scott's issue, and what does this mean for the issue in Florida?
Well, the Supreme Court just decided not to hear the case without comment. They denied certiorari, you know, which means that they're not going to grant any hearing any further. So what it means is that the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decision from last year stands. And what that decision did was it said that Governor Scott could not just broadly issue an order to randomly drug test all these employees, as you mentioned, about 85,000, without some suspicion of drug use or some kind of special category of job, such as a law enforcement officer or somebody who operates heavy machinery in a safety type of situation.
So does that mean that the state can drug test some people, but that they have to demonstrate that this has some direct relationship to the specific work that they do?
Yes, correct. The 11th Circuit pointed out that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the only way you can do this with state workers is when you have a kind of a reasonable assumption that they are in a safety and security type of job, or could be, for example, working with children or something like that as well.
Let me turn to Professor Kim on this. Professor Kim, Governor Scott is not alone in his desire to drug test employees. In fact, a number of state and federal government jobs do require it. And as Kurt Anderson was telling us, mostly for specific jobs that involve safety, like operating heavy machinery or certain positions, say, in law enforcement. Are there some states that have very broad-based testing regimens, and what allows those to go forward?
Well, I don't think any state that I know of has tried to implement testing on such a widespread basis as we saw in Florida. And I think that's because, as the 11th Circuit said, it's not constitutional. There were a pair of cases that the Supreme Court decided back in 1989 that kind of laid out the legal framework for deciding cases like this. And there were two types of employees involved in those cases. One were railroad employees, who are obviously doing jobs that have significant health and safety implications. They're driving these enormous locomotives. And then the second category of workers were customs officials, who were involved in drug interdiction and are required to carry firearms. And in those two cases, the Supreme Court made clear that drug testing of employees, when it's done by the government, does implicate the Fourth Amendment privacy rights of those individuals. And so it can only occur if there's an important government interest that outweighs it. And in those two cases, because of the type of work at stake, it was found to be justified. But how that extends to kind of ordinary employees at a county, at a clerk's office, not at all clear that a state could order drug testing.
Somebody who processes marriage licenses, for example.
Right.
Kurt Anderson, how did the employees in Florida react to this? I mean, who initially objected to this?
The primary objectors were one of the main state worker unions, and then the American Civil Liberties Union joined in with that as well. Just exactly what Professor Kim just said regarding the broadness of it. And what the program was going to be here was random drug testing of all these employees plus all applicants for new jobs. So it was about as broad as can be. And I just wanted to go back. The 11th Circuit pointed out that when the state was trying to argue that all these job categories could be included, They said that the state had brought examples such as when a person is driving a car in a workplace parking lot, that that's a danger, that, well, what if they knocked over a stack of heavy boxes? And just a quote from what they said was that we reject the idea that a stack of heavy boxes or a wet floor falls within the same ballpark of risk as the operation of a 10,000-ton freight train or the danger posed by a person carrying a firearm. So that pretty much puts it in a nutshell how they felt about the state's argument.
Just to go backwards, the state's argument was that this was a measure to protect other employees from employees who might be drug impaired. Is that was their contention?
Other employees, property, anything that, suppose you, if you were in a drug-addled state, supposedly, if you knocked something expensive over, that would be a loss. It was about as broad as a definition as anyone could think of.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about mandatory drug testing and the conflict over privacy concerns. Our guests are Kurt Anderson, a legal affairs reporter for the Associated Press in Florida, and law professor Pauline Kim of the Washington University School of Law. Kurt Anderson, let's wheel around, because Governor Scott went beyond government employees in his desire to implement drug testing. The state also tried to require drug testing for people who are receiving government benefits, specifically welfare benefits. And as I recall, that was also part of his campaign for office. I mean, so it's kind of a pivotal philosophical position of his, right? What happened with that? Was that issue brought forward, too, as part of this lawsuit?
Yes, yeah, separate lawsuit. Just to backpedal a bit, that was actually passed by the legislature with the governor's support and signed into law by him in his first year of his first term. And so that was a little different, of course. And what it did was it said not existing welfare recipients, but those that were applying for benefits would have to be drug tested. That one was challenged again by the ACLU, and the ACLU represented, I believe, an applicant, you know, to get a person who was actually affected. And that was struck down as well by a federal judge in Orlando on New Year's Eve of last year. And it is now being appealed by the state to the very same 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And it's in the midst of, you know, the briefings and all that. So it's going to be a ways. But I have a feeling that Governor Scott, given his track record, if he loses again, will still try to get the Supreme Court to hear this one as well.
Professor Kim, what about that? It's my understanding that some states do require drug screening for welfare benefits now, Utah, Oklahoma, and Arizona. What are the legal arguments pro and con, and how is it that these testing regimens are still sustained?
Well, I think that the legal arguments in the context of testing welfare recipients is really the same as or very similar to the context of employment. To the extent the Supreme Court made clear that drug testing employees implicates important privacy interests that are protected by the Fourth Amendment, that same reasoning would apply to welfare recipients as well. What would be different is the context in which the testing has occurred and the question of whether the government has an important interest in that testing. Now, the kinds of arguments I've heard in terms of supporting these types of testing programs are that they'll protect children and that they'll save the state's money. I don't think there's any real clear evidence that drug testing programs achieve either of those purposes. And really, my sense is these programs, to the extent that they're out there and apparently they're becoming increasingly popular, they're really about symbolism. They're about government or particular public officials trying to take a stand about their views of illegal drug use. The problem is in the employment context, the courts have been pretty clear that a symbolic stand is not a sufficient justification for drug testing that burdens someone's privacy rights.
Kurt Anderson, Governor Scott, as you mentioned, is up for re-election this year. Florida voters, as I understand it, also will have the option to consider approving medicinal marijuana use. What happens if people use these substances on their own time, apart from the workplace, or in another state where that use is legal? Has that been discussed as part of the debate? What happens there?
Well, not that specific instance, but just to let you know that on the medicinal marijuana vote, that's a referendum that the people are going to vote on. It requires a 2/3 vote to pass, and it's probably going to pass. And you know, there's a lot of questions like that that aren't really answered. However, these things we're talking about regarding the drug testing of employees and welfare recipients, that certainly, if you had a medicinal marijuana that was legal and you had people that were legally prescribed to have it, it would seem like that would be a non-starter in terms of being able to adopt a policy like this.
Hey, Professor Kim, what about that? Has this area been tested where you have maybe drug testing regimens bumping up against people's right to use certain substances in their private lives when they're off duty. How is this issue being resolved at present?
Well, so one thing to keep in mind in the private sector, again, public sector, the Fourth Amendment applies. But in the private sector, there are very few restrictions on what an employer can require of its employees or the basis on which it can make decisions to discipline or terminate an employee. So in most states, employers do have the freedom to make personnel decisions based on what their employees do off-duty, whether or not it involves illegal drugs, marijuana.
So, Professor Kim, if we could conclude kind of where we started out. I started asking Kurt Anderson at the beginning of our conversation, so I want to ask you to conclude it. Where did the Supreme Court leave us on this question of how far the state can go in requiring these kinds of regimens? Did they send it back to the states to kind of determine what's appropriate and what's not within kind of a narrow framework? Did they actually give us any additional guidance?
I think when the Supreme Court declined to accept the case from the 11th Circuit that came out of Florida, I think it was basically saying that what the 11th Circuit did there was consistent with its earlier decisions in the 1989 cases I mentioned earlier. In other words, it kind of laid out the framework to be applied in these settings, and it thought the 11th Circuit was applying it correctly, and it didn't see a need to intervene again at this point in time. Doesn't mean all the questions are answered, but at the moment it seems to be happy with the framework that it has set out, and it's really up to the lower courts to figure out how to apply that framework in specific settings.
Pauline Kim is the Charles Nagel Professor of Law at Washington University School of Law. She joined us from St. Louis Public Radio. Kurt Anderson is a legal affairs reporter of South Florida for the Associated Press. He joined us from NPR member station WLRN in Miami. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
Today we want to talk about food and security. Many people around the world just finished celebrating the major holidays, Easter and Passover. They probably had big family and even community-wide feasts. But that reminded us that according to the United Nations, nearly an eighth of the world's population suffers from chronic hunger. While that number is down since 2010, hunger persists despite unparalleled technological know-how. We wondered why hunger is still a problem in a wired, tech-savvy world. So we've called upon our next guest, Kanayo Nwanze. He is the head of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, at the United Nations, which works to fight hunger in rural areas. I caught up with him in our D.C. studios on a recent visit to the U.S. Kanayo Nwanze, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Can I start with a basic question? You say that there's technology available now that can get food to a lot of people that are going hungry right now. Why aren't they getting it? Why isn't it working?
You know, that's really true. We say to ourselves that the world produces enough food to feed 7 billion people, and yet about 1 billion people still go to bed hungry. The problem is not so much as the quantity of food that is produced, it's what about to do with accessibility and its availability at affordable prices. The irony of it is all is that in the developing world, where those that produce the food that feeds about 80% of the populations are the ones that go hungry.
I mentioned that the number of people going chronically hungry has actually declined in recent years. Why is that? And I'd also like to, of course, know what your agency is doing to address this.
The number has declined from over close to 1 billion to about 845 million. For me, that's irrelevant. The fact that every day one child goes to bed hungry, we have not done our job. Simple as that. And because, you see, the fact that 75% of the poor live in rural areas means that we have to invest in rural transformation.
How do you do that? How do you go about deciding where to invest your resources and what kinds of resources do you invest?
For us, we target rural populations. So it's not a question of having to find them. We know where they exist. They live in rural areas. So our investments are 100% targeting rural populations. And more importantly, because in these rural areas, we know the pivotal role that rural women play, we target empowering rural women. So there you see our priorities, our focus is cut out for us. Now, the point is, how do you help them to build the assets? Because what is important here is building their resilience. And to be able to build resilience is not what you do from one day to the other and it's done. It's long-term investment to build the assets to be able to absorb shocks, whether those shocks are due to civil crisis, due to climate change, or due to extreme weather conditions. We have to help them to build their resources, to empower them to have access to the necessities of development, access to financial services, access to land, for example.
Is part of the problem here to keep people on the farm and show them that that can be a good way of life? Because you would see that you're struggling year after year after year and that people are kind of gravitating toward urban areas and not struggling that way. At least that's what you think. Is that part of the challenge, is to persuade people that they can have a good life and remain on farms?
Well, the problem is bigger than that. The problem is that food is grown in rural areas, not in urban cities. That's point one. Now, when governments invest in ensuring that urban populations are well fed, that means they do not invest in rural areas that produce the food. So there's a tendency for rural youth to migrate into urban cities. But what happens? You have the urban bulge. Essentially, they move into urban areas where they lose the security of the communities in the rural areas. They become more frustrated because moving to the urban areas does not necessarily mean they find jobs. So they become frustrated and they become very susceptible to rhetoric. They become easily diverted into less normal activities. And so what happens is that you find the urban areas begin to evolve nothing but ghettos. So you have ghettos that are swarmed by unemployed youth, and which become really a danger to society. So I think basically what we're saying here is that government policies have to recognize that the need for us to invest in the rural space, and they have to understand the nexus between the rural and the urban.
Do you see any success stories that you could point to as an example of where these kinds of principles are coming into play to achieve the results that we're talking about here, alleviating hunger, creating kind of a more inclusive society where everybody feels that they have an opportunity to succeed, and also creating a secure food supply? Is there an example you can point us to?
Well, I can certainly speak about IFAD's work, for example, in Guatemala, where we supported rural farmers to organize themselves into cooperatives, basically giving them access to financial services, infrastructure, and where their productive ability has increased, so that productivity is high and they are organized and they're able to access into markets. And this particular group I'm talking about, which is called AgriSEM, we help them to build their own institutional framework that they're able to sell their produce to international markets. AgriSEM today, through a partnership with this cooperative, is beginning to supply food items like cut beans and onions and tomatoes to the markets of Miami, and their primary client is Walmart.
How do you, though, address the question of violence? I mean, there are places now where agriculture is continually disrupted. In Mexico, you know, we've recently reported on the fact that some of the drug cartels have figured out that limes are lucrative, so they're stealing the crop from the farmers. I mean, how are farmers supposed to fight people with guns?
I'll give you an example which comes from my own country, Nigeria. I was there last September, where I visited a project in the Niger Delta. And there I met, you know, youth who used to be basically very restive, and through organizing them and giving them access to financial resources and linking them to markets, they have, you know, been able to organize themselves and are farming. And here is fish farming. Okay. So 2,000 youth are now able to make money growing fish, catfish, as well as diversification into vegetables. So actually you are increasing the nutritional intake of the youth.
And for people who are familiar, the Niger Delta is one of those areas that's been particularly noted for a lot of conflict around the oil fields and a lot of conflict around various issues. And so you're saying if you show people another way,
exactly,
they will take that way.
Yeah.
Final thought, if I could, from you. It's interesting that in this country, before we went on the air, we were actually having an interesting discussion about food. You know, there's been kind of a renewed interest in fresh, locally grown food in this country, a real kind of move away from big processed foods, etc. On the other hand, a lot of people see that stage of development as being essential to alleviating kind of the basic of hunger. And I just wonder if there's a way you can marry those two ideas.
And I think the trend today of people going back to natural foods, to home gardens and the rest, is basically back to nature. The food that you eat has to be something that nourishes your body. So it's not just the quantity, but also the quality. And for us, what we encourage in our rural communities is for them to grow more food, not necessarily in large areas if they don't have the land, but to grow enough food that they have surpluses that they can commercialize their produce and have access to markets. So commercialization is not necessarily big. It can be small. And by linking small producers with larger producers or larger markets, you need the back and forth. So I think it's a question of both big and small farms working together.
That was Kanaya Nwanze. He is the head of IFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development. That's a special United Nations agency. And he was kind enough to stop by our studios in Washington, D.C. on a visit to Washington. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
If you had a few days off for spring break and you turned on the television, you might have stumbled across the 1956 Cecil B. DeMille blockbuster, The Ten Commandments. That spring staple may be one of the few times increasingly secular Americans think about the origin of the commandments, which, by faith tradition, were delivered to the Hebrew prophet Moses. For centuries, these commandments have been viewed by believers as the essential guide to an ethical and faithful life. But apart from the movie or a Sunday school or a bar mitzvah study, do you ever think about how those commandments fit into the fabric of life today? That is the question the editors of the Deseret News asked, and their recently published 10-part series sought to provide answers. Joining us now to tell us more is Paul Edwards. He is the editor of the Deseret News, which is owned by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. It's based in Salt Lake City, but we caught up with him on a visit to Washington, D.C., and he's here now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Wonderful to be with you.
Now, I drew the analogy of the movie just because it seemed like every time I walked past the television, it was on. This spring, but what gave you and your editors this idea?
Well, actually, Michelle, as the Deseret News has focused its investigative journalism on some core areas of national concern around family, around faith, and so on, and we thought there would be an opportunity to find something that would touch on many of these areas.
And did you find a through line in your investigation? It's actually a very kind of original approach because you're not just investigating like the sociology of those particular commandments or the faith story. You're talking about what's the relevance of this right now.
That's
did
right.
you see any through line?
Really, the through line was that we saw a number of faith leaders, including Pope Francis, emphasizing the Ten Commandments recently. So many faith traditions have had seem to have said, we need to roll these out, talk about them. Pope Francis led an evangelization effort in Italy last year that said, how do we have a good, thoughtful, ethical life through the Ten Commandments? He called it the art of living through the Ten Commandments.
One of the findings that really stood out to me was about adultery.
Uh-huh.
Quoting from your piece, Americans place cheating on a spouse dead last on a list of acceptable behaviors behind abortion, cohabitation, pornography, out-of-wedlock births, and divorce, among others. I found that very interesting. Did you?
Well, I think some people might find that surprising because there have been so many changes in attitudes towards other kinds of sexual behavior. And yet, clearly, Americans really value marital vows. They think that stepping outside of those marital vows is a real problem. They may have less concern about premarital relations and so on, but adultery is a real concern.
And one of the other findings of your piece that I found fascinating is that one of your pieces reported that people even experience post-traumatic stress symptoms, which I think might be surprising just at how devastating it is.
Yeah, it's almost a physiological response. And yet, one of the things that was a through line in the series was how contemporary media affects our relationship to these ancient commandments.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to mention. One of the other pieces drew a very interesting observation about covetousness,
uh-huh.
in other words, envy, in the digital age. It said that the degree to which we are exposed to more things makes us want more things. Want to talk a little bit about
that? Well, we call that the Instagram effect. And really, in social media, what we're able to do is portray ourselves in our best light, and we show a lot of different things or different activities that may create significant envy among those around us. And if people aren't liking what we're doing on social media, if we're not showing enough, then people have different kinds of negative reactions to that. But there's also, yes, this envy that we get when we see someone on a great vacation or they have a swanky new piece of clothing. This is what a psychologist call relative deprivation. So it's not absolute deprivation. People may actually have a very good existence, right? They have a shelter, they have clothing, they have what they need, and yet they feel relatively deprived because now in relation to what these other people see, they have this sense of envy and concern, which is truly dissatisfying and unhealthy.
Is there anything that stood out to you, since you supervised all of these pieces and got to read all of them, and also the original reporting as it came in? Is there something that really jumped out for you?
Well, I think that the way that we work through a new canvas of social media is actually one thing that came through. So again, on adultery, what are the bounds for different kinds of relationships online? This actually was a question. Everyone's quite clear about a certain line crossed with physical relations in a marriage, but we saw this post-traumatic stress syndrome among people who had felt that there had been infidelity just even in a virtual space. How do we think about theft? The rates of crime around physical property have declined significantly, but we have significant increase in online theft, identity theft, and so on. So we're really working out our social cohesion, the rules of the game, in a very new space. And I think that was one of the main things that stood out for me, Michelle.
Well, you mentioned earlier in our conversation the whole question of thou shalt not kill, and that you noted that the murder rate has in fact declined precipitously in the U.S. I have to confess I was surprised that you didn't discuss the death penalty. Some people consider, you know, that to be state-sponsored killing, and it remains a very polarizing issue in this country, particularly given that capital punishment continues to be practiced in the United States when it isn't in other countries that we consider to be less advanced and sophisticated than this one. And I was surprised that you didn't take that up. May I ask why?
Well, we just really focused in on a few issues, right? So we couldn't take the whole gamut of this.
Well, there are 10 issues.
but on these specific ones, we went deep on one aspect. And I agree with you, Michelle. I mean, this is really a very interesting dimension in American life right now. And I think as we see real questioning of convictions, you know, the evidence that's come in about the way people have been falsely convicted, how that plays out with this particular penalty is hugely important. Let me just say, in regard to that, probably the most troubling aspect of what I saw in the series actually had to do with thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Okay, that commandment. We really explored that from the perspective of perjury, which was one strong aspect of this commandment anciently. And I was very troubled to learn about an epidemic of perjury in the United States. And in particular, I was very concerned about what it said around law enforcement officials perjuring themselves on the stand in order to get rapid conviction. And I think that goes to the very core of our criminal justice system and faith and trust in that system. So there are many other kinds of things that the Deseret News will certainly explore in the future along these lines.
Paul Edwards is the editor of the Deseret News, which is based in Salt Lake City, but he was kind enough to drop by our studios in Washington, D.C. The series is called
The 10 Today, and it's at national.deseretnews.com/10.
Paul Edwards, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure to be with you.
But first, speaking of men and boys, if you've been on a university campus lately, you've probably heard about women's studies. But what about men's studies? It might surprise you to know that men's studies is an academic discipline that's been around since the early 1970s. But there is a sense among scholars that the field is not taken seriously. The American Men's Studies Association is trying to change that, and you might be surprised by who is leading the charge. She is Daphne Watkins, the president of the American Men's Studies Association. She's the first woman and first person of color to lead the organization. We found out about that from the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's just presided over her first national conference, and she's with us now. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I mean, you know, you can imagine the trouble that some people have just with the very idea. I mean, I think a lot of people think of women's studies and ethnic studies as a counterweight to traditional views of, you know, history and other disciplines that were, in fact, created by men. So what does men's studies add that scholarship needs?
Well, it's so funny that you ask that question, because I think a lot of people believe that men's studies is in a crisis, and it's not. I think what we're going through is a very common developmental stage that most innovative and non-traditional academic fields experience. Earlier, you referred to African-American studies and women's studies, and I think what men's studies does essentially is it really allows, you know, several different scholars from different backgrounds, so the social sciences and medicine and law, and we get in the same room, Michelle, and we talk about the issues, and we, you know, bring our strengths to the table. We also admit our weaknesses, and we're honest about what we can contribute to solving the problem. And I think that's the beauty of an interdisciplinary group like the American Men's Studies Association.
Why were you drawn to it?
Well, for me, I always teach my students that research is me search. It's me trying to search within myself and my past and try to learn a little bit more about what makes me who I am. And I just remember growing up and seeing the very clear gender differences and gender roles within my own family, wondering why the men would behave a certain way and the women would behave in a totally different way. And so for me, I just really wanted to understand why, as a society and even within my own family, did we hold ourselves and restrict ourselves to such tight gender roles, and we didn't allow ourselves to sort of dance on those boundaries. Hmm. And so for me, I really wanted to explore that a little bit further. And so I became very interested in men's health and particularly Black men's depression. And I said, wow, if anybody can look at this, it should be someone with passion, regardless of whether they're a man or a woman.
Wait, when you use the word problem a couple of times, and I know that in an earlier interview, you said people don't understand the benefits of holding the problem at the middle of the table and letting everybody attack the problem. Is masculinity a problem? Is it a problem being a man?
No, I'm definitely not saying that. I think that there is a very strong literature out there that talks about the benefits of masculinity and in terms of survival and how men have been able to progress as well as they have over, you know, the centuries and decades because of their strengths. But, you know, there's a really clear sense that while there are strengths, there are also some weaknesses, and weaknesses not in terms of what they're doing wrong, but also from a scholarly perspective, how we're viewing what makes men men. And how men themselves, when they don't abide by those gender rules and those gender standards, how they truly are suffering.
So it takes maleness out of the realm of being universal and makes it specific. Is that
exactly?
Is that about right? What's been the response to your selection as president of the American Men's Association?
Well, I think as an organization...
Men's Studies Association.
Oh, mm-hmm. Certainly. That's okay. But yeah, I think as an organization, folks are just thrilled to see that there's a woman in place to lead this group. When I speak with the past president, Robert Heasley, he's just so excited to see that, you know, a woman wants to stand up and actually do this kind of work. And to use Robert's words, he said, I think it's time. I think it's time for us to really, you know, attack these issues and really lead the organization into, you know, the next few years. And I think a woman's perspective is going to really add to that discussion.
What you mean, kind of, it reinforces the notion that it's about what you care about and want to think about as opposed to what you are.
Definitely. So, because I think some people can see a disadvantage with a woman who's leading this national organization on men's studies.
Well, are there any men leading women's studies associations? I mean, I think some people might consider that a kind of an unfairness and an imbalance there. Are there?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think passion can oftentimes be the driving force behind a lot of our efforts. And so I think that's what our membership believes, and I think that's what our board believes as well.
What's the next issue you're going to undertake in your own capacity in studying this area? Very briefly,
As a
scholar of men's studies, yeah. What are you interested
Definitely.
In right now?
No, that's a great question. I'm so happy you asked that question. So my work particularly focuses on Black men's depression, and I've really been doing some work on online interventions and really trying to get a deeper understanding for if we can't get men to walk into a clinic, if we can't get them to go see their primary care physicians and sort of physically go in and seek help, is there a way that we can use technology and social media to get them some of the resources that they need? So I am creating some online interventions now that we're currently pilot testing, and we're talking about masculinities and mental health and what about masculinities can be both an advantage or a disadvantage for your mental health outcomes.
Well, keep us posted. Daphne Watkins is the president of the American Men's Studies Association. She was kind enough to join us from member station WUOM, which is in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Daphne Watkins, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now it's time for our Wisdom Watch. That's the part of the program where we hear from those who've made a difference through their lives and their work. Today we hear from a woman who is a legend in the world of dance, theater, television, and film. Debbie Allen played the iconic dance teacher Lydia Grant both in the movie and in the 1980s television series Fame.
You've got big dreams. You want fame. Well, fame costs. And right here is where you start paying in sweat. I want to see sweat. And the better you are, the more sweat I'm going to demand. So if you never had to fight for anything in your life, put your gloves on and get ready for round one.
In the years since Fame, Debbie Allen has won several Emmy Awards for her choreography, started a dance academy, and directed and produced numerous projects for the screen and the stage. She's now part of the cast of ABC's Grey's Anatomy, and she's working on a new production called Brothers of the Night, which is what brought her to Washington, D.C., where she was nice enough to stop by our studios. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So how did it feel hearing that I still hear that the steel in the voice? I don't think that's changed.
Well, you know, she hasn't changed. My voice may have deepened a little over the years, but it's still tough love. That's the world I live in with young people, and it's so needed and so necessary, and it's so relevant. You know, who is it? One of my friends was telling me, I don't know if it was Denzel. I think it was Denzel. Said, you know, Debbie, you have one of those all-time phrases. You know, De Niro's got one. You talking to me? You talking to me? And I have one. You want fame. It's one of those phrases that people love to hear and say because it's still very relevant to the whole idea of success, period.
Hmm. You know, when we last spoke, it was 2008, and you were working on a production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Yeah.
Now you're back in town looking for talent for your latest production, Brothers of the Night. That puts a spin on the classic Brothers Grimm story, The 12 Dancing Princesses. Why did you want to do a production that focuses on men and boys in dance? Why?
Because we need more men in dance. Dance is as athletic as basketball. The energy, the power, the flexibility, and the creativity that it takes to play basketball is not unlike dance.
Do you feel it's still difficult to get dads to agree to let their boys dance? That was, in fact, one of the storylines of Fame, is that
Big
one of the star dancers had to hide the fact that he was a dancer. It was something that he had to kind of keep undercover. It's still a struggle?
It's a pain in the behind. I want to tell you, because I have the same problem with my husband. I want my son, Norman Nixon Jr., I don't call him that, his name's Thump. He was really talented as a dancer when he was little, tap dancing. And I had to sneak and give him lessons. And my husband came home early one day and saw him dancing and just lost his mind. I don't know if he thought he was going to put on some tights and start, you know, flipping his hands around. I don't know what he thought. But I can tell you that that was a great part of Thump's development. And when we got to a party at a big gala, and it was TLC, everybody was all up and through, and my son got up and danced, and his daddy was so proud. I'm like, uh-uh, you don't get to get credit. No.
Because you didn't want him to dance.
You didn't want him to dance.
You didn't want him to be a professional.
But it's a
You think it's rooted in homophobia, really, honestly, at the end of the day?
I do. And it's this thing about the tights. The tights is a big problem. At the Debbie Allen Dance Academy, I don't mandate that the boys wear tights. And I have more boys in my school than any school probably in America. I must have 35. And I want to really encourage young men into the world of dance. I mean, one of my best friends who I love and miss so much, Gregory Hines, someone that I really admired. He was one of the greatest dancers of our time.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with actress, producer, choreographer Debbie Allen. I have another clip I want to play, taking you down memory lane, when you made a guest appearance as a psychologist on the show A Different World. Here it is.
What are you afraid of? Scared you go there and find out that he doesn't love you anymore, honey? You can't control that. The only thing you can control is how you feel. Not how you feel, but how you deal with what you feel that is real. You've got to relax, relate, and release into reality. Come on, honey. Relax, relate, release.
Relax, relate, release.
Relax, relate, release. Relax, relate, release.
A little different therapeutic strategy there than some people may be familiar with.
I forgot I had two phrases. That's another one. Yep, that was great.
Well, I want to talk about A Different World because it was one of the first programs to show a diverse college experience on television. It was set at a fictional, historically black college. It had a huge following, and some people even say that it encouraged people to go to HBCUs who weren't necessarily acquainted with them. You were one of the producers and directors who's been credited with making the show what it was, and I was wondering if at the time, did it feel like it was going to be what it was? Did it feel special, like creating a new thing?
It felt like that to me when I came in, when Bill Cosby sent me in to take the show over and make it relevant. Felicia and I had both gone to Howard University, so we knew...
Your sister Felicia Rashad.
Yeah, we knew what a black campus in the South would be like, and there was just no hot sauce on the table, and there was no real political through line for those students. You know, in a country like America, students are not active, then the country's on the way to being done. The students, the young people, have got to have a voice, have got to be emotional, be expressing something. So I got there, and I changed a lot of things. And you could say I put hot sauce on the table. That says everything, because there was no fraternity life. There was no talk about racism. There was no talk about sexism. There was no talk about politics. And when I got there, all of that changed. So
to do a program about a black campus without putting some politics in it and showing that these kids had a grounding and that just was wrong. It felt false.
It wasn't true. So we have all the fun. I mean, I went to Howard Girl, child, those parties, please. Ooh, Lord,
step
Friday.
Right now. You're giving too much away.
No, it's so good. It was so good. But we tripled the enrollment of historically black colleges and other colleges, too, because white kids were watching the show, too. It wasn't just black kids. All kids were watching it. It made it cool to go to college, you know, and they might have been disappointed if it wasn't like Hillman, but we served a purpose, which was so important. We were the first show to address AIDS in network television. I was having a table read at my house when Magic Johnson made the announcement. I'd never seen grown young men cry like that, openly just sobbing that Magic Johnson had AIDS. And I knew we had to do something about it. So we started creating a path for this story. By the time we did the show, the advertisers were pulling out. And they were threatening not to show the show. And I'm like, guys, if we save one life, it was worth it.
After all that, when we talked back in 2008, one of the things you talked about was the fact that even after doing this groundbreaking work, you still found yourself pigeonholed when you were trying to do other directing job. People say, oh, you do the black stuff. Is it still that way? Do you feel now that it's kind of come full circle where, I mean, you were always doing very diverse projects, but has that changed now where an artist like yourself, do you see my point? Do you still feel you have to fight stereotype or you have to fight pigeonholing?
No, you know what I've had to fight? I've had to fight misrepresentation. You know, when you have people who love you, who really care about you, but they basically answer the phone, they're not aggressively out there. And I've been directing Grey's Anatomy for the last 4 years, and of course I'm in the show. But it's just been a revelation to a lot of people that I'm really talented as a director as I am in so many other things that they know about. So I've been having...
But you've been directing all along. I mean, you've
been
directing for years.
I have been, but it hasn't been like somebody's been out there saying, hey, Debbie, you know, I directed the pilot of Fresh Prince. I directed Quantum Leap, Family Ties, all these things.
So do you think, in fact, you directed Family Ties before you did A Different World. That's
I did.
What was so...
And I was offered the season.
So let me ask you, is that a girl thing or is that an African-American thing?
It's both. A girl thing is a problem, especially when it comes to movies, feature films. I did movies for Disney, and I got calls from every studio in town because the Polly movies that I did years ago, I wrapped a day early, came in $200,000 under budget. Every studio was calling me. But I'd go into these meetings with various producers, and one of them finally said to me, you know, Debbie, you got the best take on this. It was something about basketball. I knew this better than almost anybody they could talk to. He said, you know, but you won't get this job because you're a girl. I said, wow, really? Okay. And so you learn in time that what are the limitations people put on you, they don't exist for you. That's them. That's not you. And you mustn't get angry. You just have to keep working and doing what you do and keep your hand on the plow. That is the phrase. Keep your hand on the plow.
Is there one thing you really want to do before you hang up your tights?
Honey, those tights ain't going to never be hung up. I think they're going to bury me with them on, honey. They might have holes, but they'll be on, child. I got them on now.
No. Okay, is there anything you haven't done that you're dying to do?
I really want to, I did this already, but I want to get it out there. I did Freeze Frame. This was a musical, very relevant right now. It's really about young people in the inner city, their struggles against gun violence. And it's a musical, and it's fantastic. And I really want to get it across America. So that, I want to get that going. And I'd also love to direct an opera. That's something I have not done that I would love to do.
I have no doubt that you will. And hopefully you'll come back and talk to us when you do.
Yeah, okay.
Debbie Allen is an Emmy Award-winning choreographer, actress, producer, director. Need we go on? She was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios while she was in town casting for her latest production, Brothers of the Night. Debbie Allen, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.